The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm pleased to be here. Kevin Kwan's novel, Crazy Rich Asians, was an international bestseller, translated into 30 languages, and the opening volume of the trilogy of books, including China Rich Girlfriend and Rich People Problems. The 2018 film adaptation was also a huge success. It became the highest-grossing romantic comedy in more than a decade and featured one of the first all-Asian principal casts in a major Hollywood film since 1993's The Joy Luck Club, helping to launch a reckoning within Hollywood of its severe lack of Asian representation. His new novel, Sex and Vanity, is an homage to E.M. Forster's novel, A Room with a View. But in this version, the story moves between Capri and New York, tackling nuances of race and identity in the process. A review in The Atlantic called it the Shakespeare of status anxiety. This evening, Mr. Kwan will be joined in conversation with Nydia Han, consumer investigative reporter and co-anchor of 6ABC Action News Sunday mornings. Thank you all so much for joining us. Kevin and Nydia, the screen is all yours.
Laura, thank you so much for that generous introduction, and a special thanks to our audience members, and of course, a huge thanks to you, Kevin Kwan. I am so excited to talk to you tonight.
It's so great to be here in amazing, beautiful library, conservatory, tea room. Looks beautiful.
You are very kind. I like your background too. You're joining us from your home in LA, right?
I am.
Okay. Listen, I'm a huge fan of your delicious storytelling, and especially as an Asian American and the mom of two Hapa kids, half Asian, half Caucasian kids, I think I have an extra layer of appreciation for your amplifying our experiences in the most captivating of ways so that we feel seen and heard. So thank you so much for the work that you do and bring into the world.
You're more than welcome.
So your new book, Sex and Vanity, is so many things. It is a, at times, heart-aching love story, a brilliant, delightful comedy, and a social commentary on racism and classism. So when you set out to write, is there an intention there? Is it to entertain, educate, inspire, all of the above?
It really is all of the above, actually. And I think that intention has been honed more and more since book one. You know, when I first wrote Crazy Rich Asians, that was a labor of love. That was completely, you know, a flight of fancy. I didn't even know it was going to be published. But after it did get published and I saw the effect it was having on the reading public, it got me serious. You know, it got me thinking that there is a responsibility I have now, you know, to write books that not only entertain, but that also allow people a way into to thinking about topics that might be more difficult, but perhaps I'm able to do it in a way that also makes them laugh.
I want to ask you a lot more about that, but you know, for all readers, diverse readers, Sex and Vanity could not have come at a better time, and that is amid the pandemic. It was such a nice escape to go to Capri, Italy, and the fabulous places in New York City and the Hamptons. So what was the pandemic like for you?
I mean, we're sort of still in it. In a way, right? I would say the earlier part of the pandemic was I think like most people, it was extremely, extremely anxiety provoking. You know, I felt much luckier than many people, you know, in the sense that I have more space. You know, I'm in beautiful LA where I could actually still kind of go outdoors a little bit instead of being trapped in a tiny apartment with lots of kids or with multi-generational families, you know, But it was still, you know, I worried for friends, for family, for loved ones. And as in those early days, you know, when we really didn't know anything about the virus, it was extremely, extremely concerning. I think things have definitely changed now, you know, and the mood has changed and the mood is lifting. And hopefully we're all, you know, going to be in this period of healing.
And you had some hesitation about releasing Sex and Vanity during this time, right?
Yeah, we really did. The book was supposed to release in July of 2020. And early on, you know, I was engaging with the publishers in discussing, because they wanted to move the date closer to June, since they had reshuffled a lot of other books. And so they wanted to put me front and center in the summer. And I was like, should we even release it this year? You know, I don't want to be tone deaf. I want to be mindful of what's happening out there in the world. And is it more appropriate that we try to do it next year, maybe even the year after? But they convinced me that this, you know, last summer was the right time to do it. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad.
I'm so glad too. I mean, it really was a treat, and to be transported to these places and these beautiful lives was really such a nice escape. So like Crazy Rich Asians, Sex and Vanity involves not only gorgeous places, but wonderfully colorful, complicated characters and extraordinary wealth. So you write about the world of privilege in a way that makes it clear you know that world intimately. So can you talk about your upbringing?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Singapore. You know, I lived there till I was 11 years old. And I grew up, you know, very fortunate in a privileged family. But of course, as a kid, you're not really aware, you know, about who's who and how much someone's worth, or even how much the house you're living in is worth. You know, to me, it was just my childhood. It was just my life. And so to me, it seemed normal. It wasn't until I actually left Singapore at age 11 and moved to suburban Houston, Texas, to a very normal middle-class life that I realized, okay, so the life I had, which is now over, was quite different, you know, and this is a new reality that I have to adjust to. And, you know, it was done very purposely. My dad really did not want his kids to grow up spoiled brats. You know, he really wanted to take us out of that goldfish bowl of privilege and put us in a world where we would learn how to mow a lawn, you know, and take the garbage out every night and learn to be extremely self-reliant. And I'm truly grateful that, you know, he made that decision for us, because I think it's really made me who I am, you know.
So did he spark your fascination with snobbery and elitism and social hierarchy?
Not him at all. You know, my dad was totally salt of the earth, like a very, very humble, down-to-earth person. He had absolutely no patience for that world, which is kind of why he left, I think. You know, he grew up extremely privileged. I've heard stories and even seen photos of him as a youth. And I was told that as a little kid, he would be escorted to school every day by two people, his nanny and the chauffeur. And the nanny would walk his briefcase into the classroom for him, you know. And this is, you know, this is the 1930s and 40s. So that's extreme privilege, you know.
Because his father was one of the founding members of Singapore's oldest bank, right?
His grandfather.
His grandfather.
Okay. His grandfather, yeah. His father, my grandfather, was a doctor. You know, another very humble man, but they did grow up with this privilege, you know, and I think it actually demystified it for my dad. He had no patience for pretentious people. He had no patience for snobbery, and he, you know, wanted to be completely, he didn't want to carry his own bag. I mean, right. He didn't want someone to carry his bag, put it this way. He wanted the opposite, you know, and he wanted the opposite for his kids.
So you came to the U.S. when you were 11 to suburban Houston. What was that like for you?
I mean, it was very shocking at first. I was in complete culture shock, you know, just going to an all-American middle school, for example, you know, and more than that, missing the life I had, you know, that I was so sort of abruptly taken out of. It was such a stark contrast in many ways. But, you know, as an 11-year-old, that's the great thing, right? You adjust so easily and your new reality becomes your daily life. And I, you know, very quickly grew to love my life, you know?
You know, I lived in Houston for 3 years before I came to Philadelphia, almost 20 years ago now. Yeah. So when I was there, it was a pretty diverse place. But I imagine when you were growing up and then in the burbs there, I mean, did a lot of people look like you and me?
that would be no. Right? Yeah. And this would be 1985, mind you, right? So it's interesting. There were, I think, maybe three other Asian kids in my middle school, and they didn't want to have anything to do with me whatsoever. And I couldn't figure out why. I didn't realize that, you know, the way I dressed was weird. You know, my hair was weird. And even more confounding to them, I spoke English with a British accent, you know, so they couldn't understand. Like, I wasn't what they were used to in terms of being a FOB, you know, like a fresh off the boat. I was just this weird creature. It was fine with me. You know, I, having grown up in Singapore, I was already in this world that was so multicultural. You know, Singapore is a country where there's Chinese, Malays, Indians, Europeans, Americans. It's really a melting pot, kind of like Manhattan. So I'd grown up playing with kids of all colors, you know? And so it didn't matter to me that, okay, these other Asian kids are kind of like giving me the cold shoulder. I'll just make friends elsewhere, you know?
I understand that experience. I mean, I grew up in a community where I was the only Asian American kid in the entire neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to school, there were two other Asian American kids, but there weren't a lot of us. So I do understand mm-hmm. that. And in Sex and Vanity, you tell the story of Lucy Tang Churchill. She's half Caucasian, half Asian. Her father's side of the family is all WASP. Her mother is a third generation Asian American of Chinese descent. Tell us a little bit more about Lucy, and particularly about her sort of inner conflict and struggles with her Asian American self.
Well, you know, Lucy was an interesting character to write in the sense that my book is an homage to E.M. Forster's Room of the View. Amazing book from 1908, where he had a Lucy, that was Lucy Honeychurch. And she was a girl that was caught really between two time periods. She was a girl in the modern age of the Edwardian age, but she was really kind of trapped and oppressed by so much of the Victorian age that came before her. You know, 100 years of repression, of tradition, of you know, being told that you can't have feelings, or you can't ever show your feelings, of women being just very, very decorative, you know. So I, in the beginning, was trying to figure out, like, how do I create my Lucy in a way that is compelling for 2020? You know, how do I modernize her? How do I take this story and this character and show her conflict? And I quickly realized that the best way to really demonstrate that was to show, you know, the essential conflict of being mixed race, of being pulled by two different cultures within you at the same time, and growing up in a culture where you're getting a lot of different mixed signals all the time about what is to be valued about yourself.
And she really felt othered, not just by strangers, but by people within her own family on her father's side. And then that sort of turned into bit of self-hatred on that for her. Is that right?
I think that would be an accurate assessment. Yeah. You know, I think, and it's very specific to the world that she grew up in. You know, Lucy grows up in the extremely privileged world of high WASPs. You know, these are the power elite of Manhattan. You know, her family, her father's family goes back generations to a Wall Street fortune, and then they're intermarried with British aristocracy. So it's a very specific world. It's a very specific world of elitism and snobbery. So along comes Lucy, and, you know, as much as they try to love her, and they do because she's a member of the family, you know, there are all these trip ups. You know, her grandmother calls her a China doll, you know, which is unintentionally hurtful. And that's a true story, by the way. You know, so much of how I drew Lucy was based on so many stories. So what I did was I interviewed so many friends and family members who are Hapa, you know, who are mixed race. And I wanted to hear about their different experiences. And as you know, there is no one monolithic Hapa experience. Everyone grows up with a completely different experience based on where they grow up, when they're growing up, who their parents are, what the parents emphasize and value and teach them to appreciate. So for Lucy, she was in this complex situation of having well-intentioned relatives who were trying to appreciate her, but not realizing that sometimes they were unintentionally racist. And so how do you contend with that, you know, in that particular milieu of privilege? And then you add to that, you know, growing up, just even just being a girl, you know, in this generation, with all the pressures of social media, of the beauty standard and all that, especially when you are, you know, she presents more Chinese than Caucasian. So what is that like in her world? That's what I wanted to look at.
Yeah, you tell the story, and there are no spoilers here, but just one incident from the story when Freddie, her brother, who looks more Caucasian than Asian, is walking with her on the streets of New York, and a woman yells only at Lucy, effing Asian tourist, right?
Yeah. Once again, another story told to me by a friend, you know, who had a sibling that looked much whiter than she did. And, you know, always passed, whereas she looked like the Asian tourist on the streets, you know.
And I think that this is the kind of story that anyone of mixed race could probably identify with and would probably resonate, right? Whether you're black, half white, or I have a friend who's half Filipino, half black. I mean, I think a lot of people can really understand this experience and feel this experience.
I think so, yeah, which is why I wanted to really sort of bring light to it in as sensitive a way as I possibly could.
And the way you're able to inform and shine a light on it is so wonderful because it is so captivating and I think really brings people to this place of understanding in a way that most people simply can't do. So thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was, you know, trying to put it in the world where you would actually be amused and laugh. And through that laughter, perhaps, you know, think a little bit.
Yeah. So when you began writing, I mean, did you intend to tackle issues of racial prejudice and anti-Asian sentiment in America? Or did those themes kind of surface as you were writing?
No, I think there was intention there to look at that, you know, through my lens, of course, you know, and, you know, this book was, of course, written well before all the recent incidences of Asian hate that have cropped up in the past year. But I did want to look at it, you know, in as thoughtful a way as possible.
I mean, we know
these characters.
We know that this Asian hate, this rise in hate and violence that we're seeing right now is deeply rooted in these sentiments of Asian Americans as the perpetual foreigner, even the enemy. Will you continue to tackle these kinds of topics in the Sex and Vanity trilogy? And it will be a trilogy, right?
It will be. It's an unconventional trilogy in the sense that, you know, Lucy's story is complete at the end of this book. So the next book, there will be new characters, new storylines. The connective tissue really is the cities. You know, I call it the cities trilogy because this was the New York book. Okay. The next book is going to be set in London. And the final book in the trilogy is going to be set in Paris. So it's the New York, London, Paris trilogy. And, you know, there'll be interesting through lines that connect them. I can't give away too much. you know, some characters might appear in other books, you know, over and over again, but by and large, they will be standalone stories. But yeah, the first series I did, the Crazy Rich Asians series, of course, was to me looking at Asians in Asia. Mm-hmm. And I really always wanted to do the next series about Asians outside of Asia, Asians in the West, and to look at that collision of what happens with Asians living in Western countries. And so I thought, you know, let's kick things off by someone who embodies that. you know, perfectly. Lucy Tang Churchill.
She is such a wonderful character. I mean, they all are, though. Even Cecil, whom you seem to sort of mock and dislike in the beginning, then has a lot of humanity to him for the end.
I mean, I love all my characters, right? So I have great affection for Cecil, you know, and it's interesting to sort of look at him and to see, you know, where does his snobbery come from? You know, snobbery always comes from insecurity, ultimately, right? Because secure, happy people do not have to feel like they have to put down other people or do not have to feel like they're better than others, you know? So where does his come from? And so I wanted to, you know, with him, with each character, you know, also look into their backstories and
his
see
evolution
why they are, why they are. Yeah.
His evolution really surprised me. That was really fun to read and sort of see his character develop and unfold. I've heard you say that you don't have an imagination, that you just have the keen sense of observation. Is that right? And what do you mean by that?
In the sense that I feel like I'm much more of a journalistic observer, and I take these experiences and I fictionalize them. You know, I weave them into my fiction. I can't possibly have created the world of Crazy Rich Asians. You know, I don't have that kind of imagination. You know, it was all simply through observation, in the same way that in this book, you know, so much of it was my observations based on spending time in Capri, and also my observations having lived in New York and summered in the Hamptons for over two decades.
I need your life. You have said that Sex and Vanity is more personal for you than Crazy Rich Asians, and that it was written straight from the heart. Why is it more you? How is that so?
It's more me in the sense that I also feel that in many ways, I'm kind of at this confluence of East and West. Mm-hmm. You know, I may not be Hapa at all, you know, but I feel like I've really lived a life in the East and in the West, and I've been able to really kind of see and experience a lot of that tension of like, what does it mean, you know, to be born in Asia, to be Singaporean and to be living in this country, but also feeling tied to the traditions and the expectations of having Singaporean Chinese parents, you know, a Singaporean Chinese family. So in that sense, it's personal, but this book was also my Valentine to New York. You know, New York really nurtured me and it took me in, and it's where I really kind of found my voice, my artistic soul, and best times of my life, you know? So I really wanted to sort of remember and commemorate that and the parts of New York that I truly love, you know, many of which kind of no longer exist.
You were working as a design consultant in New York when you started writing Crazy Rich Asians, right? I mean, you had a full-time job as a design consultant.
I had more than a full-time job. You know, I worked for myself. So like when you have your own company, you're pretty much working nonstop. You're on the clock on the weekends. You're on the clock at night when you're thinking about or stressing out over a client and how to maintain a project. It was a great, great career. And in many ways, I miss it. You know, I miss being on teams and collaborating on big projects with other amazing creative people. You know, writing is a pretty lonely vocation. Writing books.
With the movie, though, that was quite the collaboration, right?
That was, yeah. And that's why that was so much fun, you know, to sort of be in that team of you know, the amazing directors and actors, and then the designers, the set designers, the costume designers, the food stylists, the location scouts. That was truly fun for me because I could really dork out on my design side. You know, I had no interest in writing the screenplay. I was like, I want to leave that to the experts. Like, we need an amazing screenwriter like Pete Chiarelli to really kind of transform my book. Let me help you with the sets. Let me help you with the visuals. And that's what I did.
It really was a feast for the eyes. It was so gorgeous. But I know that a producer actually suggested to you that the main character, which Constance Wu ended up playing, should be played by a Caucasian actress. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was very early on. Yeah. That was actually right before the book was released. So the book came out in May of 2013. And by March or April, there was already a lot of buzz around it. And, you know, Hollywood was circling and a lot of studios were interested. And, you know, a very prominent producer, you know, said, oh, I'd be interested, but you got to change Rachel and make her white. That's the only way the movie's going to work. And I was like, not interested. Sorry, you've missed the point completely, you know?
That is just extraordinary. Yeah. I guess it shouldn't be that shocking, but for some reason, I am shocked to hear that and really disappointed, but so glad that you reserved the right to, you know, have control over what, you know, who the characters were and who the cast was and how it all played out, because it certainly was just fabulous the way it ended up.
Thank you. Yeah, it would have been completely tragic. And I would have had no interest in seeing that movie being brought to life. You know, the whole point of the books was to showcase and celebrate the Asian culture. Right.
And you ended up selling the rights for $1, right? So that you could retain that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I found these amazing partners and you know, we were scrappy and I was like, well, let's really spend the money on building the best team possible. Let's spend the money on hiring an amazing screenwriter to adapt it. Like, you don't have to pay me some ridiculous sum now. You know, let's all go into partnership and try to make this happen with the best people possible. So that's what we did. It was truly a labor of love that we never thought would turn out to be what it did.
And look at you now, Kevin Kwan. I mean, you've been featured in the Hollywood Reporter's Most Powerful Authors list, Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. I mean, do you feel pressure now because you are such an important Asian American voice? Do you feel like you have to just get everything just right?
You know, not really, because I feel like in many ways, they've totally made a mistake putting me on those lists. You know, like I can't take any of that seriously. You know, I'm honored, of course, but it's like, you know, it's so subjective. Like, you know, so many amazing people deserve to be on these lists that aren't on the lists. You know, it's editorial content in many ways. So I just try to do what I do, right? And I think it's important for me. You know, I feel a responsibility to get things right, right? To really be journalistic in my approach, to really tell stories that are meaningful and that really resonate and that are true to the characters and true to the people. But beyond that, like whether it's a success, whether it resonates, like I have no control over how it's received. Well, so listen, I just got to do my thing, you know?
In my book, you absolutely belong on both of those lists and many more. So you're very humble. I appreciate
you. You were too kind. So do you.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you're in a very
putting me on one of those lists, Kevin.
But you're in a very small, exclusive group, you know, of anchor women of Asian descent. It's pretty amazing. So, and hopefully there'll be more.
Yeah, I hope that there are, and I am very grateful for this platform, and I also feel a responsibility, and I do take it seriously. So, thank you. Sex and Vanity and the Crazy Rich Asians trilogy have this universal theme of love. So you must be quite the romantic. Describe for me your perfect writing setting.
Oh, wow. Well, I don't want to demystify people, but it's pretty, pretty run of the mill. It's called the corner over there. You know, I have a small corner where there's a dining table and I put my laptop there and that's where I write. So, people who are imagining some amazing writing studio with a view of the ocean, that's not the case. That's not the case. Yeah, it's all in my head, you know.
Don't you sometimes listen to love songs as you're writing, Kevin?
You know, you've done a lot of your homework, haven't you? Yeah.
That's my job, man.
So, yeah, no, I cheat. I cheat. I'm totally into music, right? So I've always... Depending on the scenes I'm writing, I will listen to different kinds of music to put me in the mood.
What kind of music do you like?
I mean, I have such a huge, you know, breadth of interests. but when I'm writing the love scenes, you know, it's interesting. I've chosen specific songs, you know, to listen to in pivotal moments of my book. It's actually usually the really sad scenes where, like, I turn up the Jeff Buckley. You know what I mean? Like, Hallelujah is like playing on a constant loop, you know, or Jake Bugg, you know, or Joni Mitchell. So like, that's what I do. So I cheat that way. make myself depressed as I write these scenes of like loss, you know, of heartbreak.
I would love to be a fly on the wall. So if anyone's home with you at the time, then depending on what music is playing, they can probably figure out your writing, right?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Gorecki's Requiem is playing when I'm writing a death scene, you know?
So Sex and Vanity is also, I mean, it is so funny. There were so many moments in which I just laughed out loud. So you have this ability to masterfully weave comedy with really serious subjects. I mean, is that hard for you? I mean, that's part of the craft and the challenge, I imagine.
I honestly, I have to tell you, I have no idea how I do that. Like, I don't think of myself as a funny person at all. And in fact, Crazy Rich Asians, when I first started writing the first book, it was meant to be a really, really serious book. Like, it was meant to be almost like an angry diatribe at, you know, how obscenely rich some people were and just the wealth disparity between the rich and the poor in Asia, because it's so wide, you know, the wealthy in Asia, you know, who are dollar millionaires or billionaires, just their buying power so dwarfs everyone else. So it was meant to be angry. And somewhere along the way, from my head to the fingers to the laptop, something else came out, you know, that was kind of ridiculous and that people seem to find funny. So I'm still trying to figure it out, like how that happened, but it kind of worked. So I kept on repeating it, you know, in book after book.
I love that you were surprised by that first end result. Is there anything about Sex and Vanity that surprised you once you were finished writing it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, they gave me 4 months to write it. You know, I had a very small window of time to write the book. Yeah. And so it was meant to be a novella. It was meant to be like a 180-page book. And as you can see, it's not. Right. It clocks in at close, I think, more than 400 pages. Yeah. I took a very simple idea. And what happens when I write is that the characters at some point, they really begin to take over. You know, my Lucy didn't just want to be bound to the plot lines of Lucy Honeychurch. Mm-hmm. She wanted to be so much more. She wanted to be an artist. You know, she wanted to be a woman in grief that has a lot of unaddressed grief. She wanted to be a woman who actually is reckless and makes bad decisions, you know, that makes people sometimes, you know, some readers really hate Lucy. I don't know if you had that encounter. So it's interesting how the characters take over when I start to write. And so the book kind of grew and became a very, very different beast. And I'm truly happy with what happened. But it was not the book I had set out to write. And it surprised me in the way that it kind of found itself and came to its conclusion.
So my favorite characters were George Zhao and Rosemary, his mother. Are they based on specific people you know, or sort of combination of a bunch of people?
Yeah, they are definitely both based on combinations of people. But once again, like, you know, Rosemary Zhao was supposed to be a tiny character. And now I hear from people like you and so many people like, oh my God, I love Rosemary. You know, who's going to play her in the movie? Yeah. You know, they all say that. It's like, you know, so she's a character that sort of kind of began speaking to me more and more. And so I would just keep on turning up the volume slowly, slowly, mm-hmm. slowly, you know, until she gets to where she is in the end of the movie. And as you, not the movie, Freudian slip, the end of the book. Because as you can see, she plays a very pivotal role towards the end of the book.
So listen, we all know that Sex and Vanity is going to be on the silver screen. It better be.
Knock on wood.
Any sneak preview, any sneak peeks that you can give us about who might be cast, who you'd like to see cast, what you'd like to see?
You know, I think it's such an interesting opportunity for casting, because especially with George and Lucy, right? You have a chance. I think we need to discover an amazing Hapa actress, mm-hmm. first of all, you know. So Lucy and Freddie, her brother, like, I can't wait to like find some like amazing, fresh, young talent, you know, from somewhere.
So if you wait a few years, you know, I have a daughter who's 9, who's half Caucasian, half Asian.
Hey.
And then I have a son who's 7. So
hey, it might take, you know, let's see. You know, let's see how long it takes. But you know, you can email me their headshots. Yeah. but then it's
keep them in mind in the future.
Totally. But then it's, of course, it's the first movie that also has some white characters. So yeah, I have a wish list of like who'd be fun, you know, like Charlotte, the cousin, you know, that could be a really, so many amazing people could play her, you know, Reese Witherspoon, Kate Blanchett, you know, the list is long and amazing of like people who could really make that role into their own.
Those are two of my favorite actresses. So
mine too. So
you know, because you were looking for approval from me, Kevin. Let's go back to talking about Asian American actresses and frankly, just prominent Asian Americans. I mean, a recent study showed that 42% of Americans could not name one prominent Asian American. So 42% of the people who were surveyed said, don't know when they were asked.
I read that whole survey. Yeah. And okay. I was like pretty aghast, you know, looking at the statistics and the way they designed it, you know, it really, I love looking at these graphs and like really seeing, it really shows you in high relief, like we're at base camp in terms of getting the kind of recognition, you know, and a place at the table that we need to get to.
Yeah, I mean, when you were at that most influential list for Time, the gala that they had for that list that year, 2018, right? You were with Michelle Yeoh. And can you relay the story of what happened when a publicity person saw the two of you together?
I can't believe that story still exists, but no, yeah, absolutely. We were... You know, we were on the red carpet, right? I'm sure you've had the red carpet experience. It's complete chaos because it's like a traffic jam of like talent and major stars. And Nicole Kidman and Keith Urban were right ahead of me. And J-Lo and, you know, at the time, A-Rod were behind me. And here we are in line. And there's all these publicity teams moving people along. You know, of course, the big stars come with their own PR teams. I, of course, had no one. I had the beautiful Michelle Yeoh with me.
You have Michelle Yeoh, that's even better.
I know, looking like $1 billion in her beautiful white dress and her own jewels, right? You know, she doesn't borrow clothes or borrow jewels. She's got the real stuff and it's all her own.
I want to be Michelle Yeoh when I grow.
I know. So here we are, and a PR person grabs me and grabs her, and she's like about to move us to the gauntlet, you know, but she has a cue card that she's going to write down who we are to the press so that they can then shout our names out and go, Kevin over here, Kevin over here. And they asked her for her name, and she's like, Michelle Yeoh. And the PR person goes, are you his wife? And I just laughed and I said, I wish. You know, I mean, like, how, you know, you're in PR. How do you not know? I mean, this is, you know, I'd understand if you did something else and you weren't tangentially in the media industry. But, you know, in Asia, she cannot walk down a street.
Right. I mean,
you know, alone, right? She would be mobbed because she's one of the biggest Asian stars in the world.
And you know, to me, she's one of the biggest Asian American stars. I mean, it was shocking to me that someone would not recognize her and know who she is, especially in that environment. But I mean, it just goes to show that this study that we just talked about is so true. I mean, I think after that 42% of people who said don't know, the next biggest group, 11% named Jackie Chan, who's not even Asian American. He's a Hong Kong actor, right? And then Bruce Lee, who, you know, sadly died in 1973. So I really do think we have a lot of work to do. And, you know, the work that you're doing is certainly helping us by, you know, giving all of these Asian American and now HAPA actors and actresses jobs and the opportunity to be on the silver screen and to have all of this exposure and publicity. So,
you know, just trying to do what I can, right? But, it's going to take a lot more of writers and creative people and people like you to sort of, you know, sort of break those ceilings. I feel, you know, it's a very specific problem that I think has to be conquered with just lots and lots more roles, lots and lots more visibility on TV, you know, in movies, in social media. I think I have a lot of great hope in what's happening with the new generation. You know, all the TikTok stars. Mm-hmm. There are all these amazing, you know, sort of kick-ass Asian TikTok stars now. So I think for the new generation, you know, people who are younger than me, younger than you, there's going to be a lot more visibility for these people. It's going to be much more of a diverse playing field for them. But for the rest of us, we still got to fight that fight.
I think that's right. But you're giving all of us a leg up. So again, I just can't tell you how much I thank you. We all owe you a debt of gratitude. I want to go back to sort of your writing style. So you have this way of having asterisks to provide a little more information. Mm-hmm. You know, parenthetically, you described where all of the characters went to school from primary school on up to university. Talk about sort of why you decided to tell your stories with those kind of decorations or ornaments. Mm-hmm.
Well, for Sex and Vanity, the parentheticals, the schools, that's a new thing. You know, that was my new little gimmick for this book. And I just, to me, it's a fun little device and a fun little joke that accompanies each character when you first meet them. But it also, I think for a lot of people, it informs them about who these people are, you know, in a very immediate way. And it's very satirical, because I find that in these worlds, you know, in the world of Asians and Asian Americans and high WASPy elite people in America, education is so important, and education snobbery, right? The schools you go to, people love to name drop their schools a mile a minute. And I did not grow up like that, first of all, right? And I went to school in Texas, went to college in Texas. And when I moved to New York, it just seemed so funny to me that, you know, I would go to a party and within meeting someone, after 2 minutes, they want to know where you went to school, you know, and of course they tell you where they went to school. You know, that was always so important to them. So I wanted to parody that a little bit in the new book, but also really put a lot of thought into each character so that, you know, you really can kind of like see that their trajectory in life through these schools. And the same thing with the footnotes. The footnotes began with my first books, with Crazy Rich Asians, because there was so much stuff that I didn't want to have to explain telling the story, you know, but there were like very cool curse words, for example, you know, that I wanted to translate for the audience. Or if I mentioned a food, you know, and you didn't know what it was, I wanted to be able to tell you in a different space. So it became this funny device to really like add another layer of information, but also make it entertaining, make it funny.
And it also really drew me in because I think it makes the reader really feel like they're in on the mm-hmm. inside joke or information, and like you're really talking directly to us. So I really like that.
Glad you enjoyed it.
So let me ask you if your family was supportive of your career. I mean, you went from design consultant to author. What do they make of all of this?
You know, they have always been super, super supportive. You know, I think my parents were just, you know, they were happy as long as I could pay my rent and pay for my own health insurance. You know what I mean? And sometimes they had to help, you know, when you're working freelance for many years. It's touch and go, especially in the early years. But they've always been incrementally supportive. You know, my dad, this is what he wanted for us. You know, he kind of realized early on that he had creative kids that needed to be in a different education system. Mm-hmm. You know, and he himself, you know, wasn't an academic scholar, you know. So he could appreciate that, you know, there are different types of ways of educating your kids. And I think my kids are going to do well, you know, in the American system. So he was always just very happy for us, you know, whatever we wanted to do.
And really progressive for his family, I think, sounds like, right?
Yeah, no, extremely so. You know, they weren't the typical tiger parents at all. And I think that in a way freed me to take these risks, right? And to do something that was totally out of the box, that wasn't just the conventional careers that you sort of, a lot of parents, Asian parents especially, expect you to get into.
Yeah, I think that's an education in and of itself. I mean, when I told my parents that I wanted to be a journalist, they were all for it because they thought that I was going to be writing something and that seemed like a noble profession. Mm-hmm. But then when I told them that I wanted to be a broadcast journalist, they were a little surprised and I think a little worried. And I just think it was such an unfamiliar idea to them, but they were still supportive. And for that, I'm really grateful too. And my dad always said, you know, you got to find your passion, figure out what you love to do, and then figure out a way to make a living out of it. And he did that too. So yeah, I'm really grateful for that. And we're trying to do the same thing for our kids now.
Yeah, that's very special. And they must be so proud at this point.
I hope so. We'll see. You know, Crazy Rich Asians, the fact that it did so well at the box office was a surprise to a lot of people, but not to you.
No, it was a surprise.
It was a surprise. It,
absolutely.
I knew that it would do well because it had done so well internationally. And
I mean, I knew, I didn't think it would fail, first of all. I thought it would do well. I just didn't think it would do this well, you know. Early on, you know, there were discussions within the studio and people. They're like, is this movie going to cross over? You know, by that, they mean cross over into a mainstream audience. Mm-hmm. They at first saw the movie as a niche movie. And I was like, well, think about this. Like, do you ask J.K. Rowling if her you know, books to movies are going to cross over? You know, at that point, my books were already translated into over 20, 25, 30 languages around the world, right? Mm-hmm. And I could see the success of the books. And I was like, I really feel like the audience will come. You know what I mean? Like, they're bestsellers in Australia, in Canada, all over Asia, all over the US. And if they only appeal to Asians, right, in America, that's what, 8% of the population? Mm-hmm. They would not have been bestsellers, you know? So that, I think, a lot of the studio people had a hard time wrapping their minds around. So I was confident that it was going to perform to a certain degree. But to do as well as it did, to see people come out and support it in the way that they did, and people returning to see the movie in the theater 4, 5, 6 times, that was unbelievable to me, I have to say. You know, because I was thinking, if it bombs, we'll never get a chance again to do another movie with an all-Asian cast for another 25 years.
I am so also, it's so powerful, the fact that it did so well. And, you know, it just goes to show that if you tell a good story, then it's going to resonate and it's going to appeal to the widest possible audience, right?
I've always said that, you know, and the more specific you make it to your truth, the more universal it is, you know?
Kevin, I'd like to get to some of the other audience members' questions. I could ask you my questions all night long, but we already have a lot of questions in the chat. And Catalina Loveman would like to know, will the Sex and Vanity and Crazy Rich Asians worlds collide?
That will be very interesting. They might in certain ways. I mean, you know, there's at least 3 Easter eggs in Sex and Vanity that you might find some characters that you might recognize from previous books.
Interesting.
So, you know, go find those Easter eggs.
I can't wait for the hunt. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Nicole Allen says, Kevin, can you share more about the few Easter eggs from the Crazy Rich Asians that we got in Sex and Vanity, i.e. Astrid at the wedding. I believe Kitty Pong appeared toward the end. It was fun to consider that our beloved characters exist in this world.
And that was, of course, intentional. So I wanted to, you know, just have a little treat for people who had read my books previously to this one. Little surprises here and there, and maybe hint at what could happen in the future.
Well, your fans are loving it. All right, this is from Lexis Asahi. How do you know when you've written something funny? Does it have to make you laugh? Do you write things that you don't think are funny, but know that they are and will work?
That's a really interesting question. A lot of times they have to make me laugh, I have to say. And a lot of times it surprises me what other people think is funny. But in general, you know, there are certain scenes and certain chapters, especially involving the more ridiculous characters like Mordecai, for example, where I would just be sitting there just laughing my ass off, you know, as I type the scene, because this ridiculous dialogue would come out and be like, I'm just going to go for it. And I'm laughing. So I hope people are going to laugh with me, you know, as I write this. And I also, you know, I tried writing a very funny sex scene. So hopefully people laughed when they read that. Not to give too much away, but.
Maybe I'm missing my sense of humor because I just thought the sex scenes were great. I didn't really find them funny necessarily.
Well, there's one that's intentionally supposed to be quite funny.
That's right. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
There's a little bit of role playing involved, you know?
Yes. That's right. I forgot about that. All right. So other than that sex scene, Mordecai's hilarious, his hilarity. Anything else? I mean, can you tell us one other scene that you just found yourself laughing at as you were writing it?
You know, writing the co-op letter. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to tell this without giving too much away, but there's a co-op board application letter, you know, involved in this whole shenanigans of what happens, and writing that and making it as outrageous as I could was a lot of fun, you know.
Sort of
like, how do you write the worst recommendation letter in the world, right? To make sure that person will not get hired ever.
So. But in a way that's still elegant and lovely.
Exactly. And seems like you're not doing that, you know. But yeah, you should hire him, like, especially now that he's out of jail. You should totally hire him.
He's a wonderful dad. Remy De Jesus says, you spoke about Cecil and Lucy. Can you expand on how A Room with a View inspired you? And what does the book mean to you personally? And then there are more questions. So I'm going to stop there so you can answer those first.
Yeah, that's another lovely question. Thanks. You know, I read the book for the first time when I was 15 years old. And for some reason, I think it was the year the movie came out, because it was like the hot book to read at my high school. And all the cool people were reading it, believe it or not. So I was like, what is this about? Like, I want to know what the fuss is. And I found myself just being so captivated by the internal world that he'd created, you know, because even though he had written this in 1908, it was so ahead of its time in the way that he got into the mind of Lucy Honeychurch, number one. So that was kind of cool. And it sort of in many ways mirrored the teen angst I was going through at the time, you know? And then the other layer was Italy. You know, the way he evoked Italy in the book, Florence, you know, the beauty of Italy, the way people go there and are just seduced by an entire country. I was seduced. I fell in love with Italy through the book, and it compelled me to want to go visit Italy. Previous to that, I had no interest in visiting Italy. So a couple of years later, I managed to convince my parents, you know, we took a family vacation there, and that's where I went to Capri for the first time and fell in love with that island. So it's very meaningful in that way, because, you know, the book just came at the right time. And through the book, I was introduced to my love of Italy.
You talked earlier about how the characters are based on people you know and interviews you did. Are any of the characters or do any of the stories that you write about mirror you and your experience and things that happen specifically to you?
From Sex and Vanity, particularly, there are a few, actually, you know. I'll give you one, and it's always the more ridiculous things that I put in, right? So there's a scene in the book where Cecil is invited with Lucy to have lunch at this very exclusive club, private club in the Hamptons. And so he gets all dressed up in very expensive designer clothes and shows up for lunch with his girlfriend. And he's turned away at the door because he's not wearing a collared shirt. And that happened to me, you know.
Cecil throws quite the temper tantrum. Did you do that?
I did not throw a temper tantrum at all. But I just, it was just, you know, it's interesting how a lot of these clubs, they create these really arcane rules just to keep people out. You know, like if you didn't know, then you don't belong here in a way, because this was their policy. They don't care if you're wearing an expensive designer sweater or even a shirt that's collarless. Like if I would have been wearing a Mandarin collared shirt, they would not have let me in. Your shirt has to have a collar. If it's a beat up old stained shirt and it has a collar, you'll get in. You know, but if you're wearing an expensive designer shirt that doesn't have a collar, sorry, you're out of luck. So it was, to me, it was so absurd. That absurdity made it in, you know.
Yeah, and that's part of the exclusion, I guess, is like you have to know the rules of the game to be able to play.
Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, no, I did not throw a fit. I very happily bought a collared shirt from the gift shop. And I still have it to this day, and I love it.
I want to get back to the rest of Remy de Jesus's question. So she was the one who asked about A Room with a View. So she wants to know, did the movie A Room with a View also contribute to your understanding and the formation of your characters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I've said this in the past that, you know, the movie and the book were equally inspiring to me. And I feel like my book is almost like a conversation between both. You know, the movie is also one of these, it's a timeless masterpiece. You know, I don't know if you've seen the movie or if you've seen it recently, but it doesn't date. You know, I watch it at least once a year and it's so beautifully shot. But more than that, the performances are so spot on, you know, and you see these amazing actors in their youth. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis played Cecil Vice. You know, Helena Bonham Carter played Lucy Honeychurch. I believe those were their first roles ever. And then you had Maggie Smith as the amazing Charlotte Bartlett, you know, the cousin, the snobby cousin. And, you know, it was just an amazing all-star cast. It truly was a seminal film for me as well.
It really was an extraordinary cast. And I remember very well also reading that book and watching the movie when I was about your age at around time.
So. Judi Dench, I'm just thinking, she was also in that and was amazing, you know. So just anyone who hasn't seen it, please, you know, give yourself a treat and rent that movie tonight on Netflix.
Yeah, this is the time to do it, absolutely.
Yeah.
Nicole Allen wants to know, fashion plays such a central role in your books. Can you speak to your process of when, how, what brands to incorporate, and at what time?
I mean, we could spend an hour on that, really, that question alone. You know, fashion and clothing are such signifiers for many people, and especially in these worlds, you know, especially in the world of the crazy rich Asians, labels and brands, they really, that's where they express their creativity. In Sex and Vanity, actually the fashion is dialed down, I have to say. You know, it's still there, but it's not as important as Lucy. You know, Lucy is not a fashionista. Mm-hmm. She has nice clothes. She's grown up in a world where she's always had nice clothes. So you hear about that a little bit, but it's not central to her being in a way that it is to someone like Astrid, for example, from the Crazy Rich Asian series. But I always, you know, I write very cinematically. So for me, when I imagine a scene, I really see it play out, you know, in my mind's eye, and I have to dress all the characters. So I keep folders of images, of clothing, I dress each character and for each scene, where they, you know, from head to toe. Because it really helps me to sort of position them in the scene and position their action. Because I think oftentimes what you wear does affect your mood, right? It affects how you behave in a certain setting. So, you know, there's a scene where Lucy is in Italy and she's with her friends and she's wearing a really cute sort of vintage inspired bathing suit. Mm-hmm. But it's like a one piece, right? That she thinks is kind of cute. And then she's here and she sees all these other women who are slightly older, who are way more glam, who are in much more revealing sort of European style bikinis. And she feels very self-conscious suddenly that she looks like a little girl, you know? So everything is done with tremendous purpose. Rosemary Zhao, you know, it's no accident that she dresses like, you know, Elizabeth Taylor on speed, right? She's in crazy caftans. She's got lots of huge vulgar jewelry. She's expressing her exuberance and her joy, and she's just living out loud. She doesn't care how she looks, but her appearance is embarrassing for Lucy and embarrassing for people in Lucy's world, you know, that waspy world where you're supposed to look very composed and elegant and very like Jackie O, you know, less is more. So like I said, we can go on talking for hours about this, but we'll leave it at that.
Can you talk more about Lucy's mom? I feel like she's almost this somehow a subtle character in the book, yet has so much presence and so much impact, obviously, for the storyline.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. You know, she was a really sort of fun, interesting character to write and to sort of soft pedal on in a way, because she is pivotal in how she has raised Lucy and how she has very, you know, she's very well intentioned, right? She's trying to be the opposite of a tiger mom because she grew up with a tiger mom. You know, that's why she became a doctor. Right. You know, but she's trying to have the opposite experience as a mother. She's trying to be a very cool, liberal New York mother. And then there's other stuff going on, which I won't get into because that would be giving away too many spoilers. But, you know, there's a reason why she has sublimated herself and her Asian identity and really, really tried to like push Lucy and her brother towards the father's family, you know. The Caucasian side, the New York side. And hopefully when you read the book, it all makes sense. And I've seen that actually. I mean, it was sort of inspired in many ways by a mother I knew, you know, who really just, she felt that the only thing she could do was to sublimate herself, to give her children a better chance in life, you know, her Hapa kids. And to me, there's something so tragic about that. That she felt the need to do that.
So many of our parents sacrificed so much. So as I was reading that story, certainly reminded me of, you know, the sacrifices that my parents made, different mm-hmm. ones, but sacrifices nonetheless. So mm-hmm. I appreciate it. That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
When you're writing those really painful and tragic scenes in your books, like how much of that emotion do you feel and walk away with even when you're done writing that scene?
I mean, I do really hold it. You know what I mean? Like you have to hold space for the emotion. And, you know, especially in the more raw, poignant moments, like I'm in the headspace and it takes a while to get out of it. You know, it's like I used to see actors, you know, who practice the method acted. You know, method acting and where they had to really get in character and get themselves really drunk or really hungover. And I was always like, why don't you just try acting, right? But now I see in many ways, like, you know, you can't cheat it in a way. Right. You know, you have to mentally go there and you have to sometimes go dark or go very light in order to, you know, you can't fake it. Like I wouldn't be able to write a comic scene if I was severely depressed.
Does writing feel like work? I mean, I ask that because I know, you know, there were times when I was in college, for instance, and mm-hmm. aspiring to be a broadcast journalist. And I remember a professor said, you know, there are going to be days when you don't want to do your job, where you're not going to want to go on TV. You're not going to want to interview people. You're not going to write the story. And I remember thinking, there will never be that day. I'm going to want to do this every single minute of every single day if someone will just give me the opportunity to do it, right? But, you know, it does feel like work sometimes. And when Friday comes and it's my day off, I'm usually pretty happy. So when you're writing, I mean, what does that process feel like for you?
Oh, it feels like work. Don't get me wrong. It really, you know, there are moments of joy. And I happen to enjoy what I do, right? So a lot of times I'm not miserable. But I do feel, you know, the intensity of you're on deadline. You have to produce, you know, and even if you're having a bad day, you have to kind of make it work and write something and then edit it and polish it and make it work. So it is work. You know, I think I've never read a writer who actually likes to write, quite frankly.
Interesting.
So that's very revealing. You know, it takes a lot out of you to just be able to like create a paragraph, a chapter, a story, and actually make it coherent.
I certainly don't write the way you do, but, you know, I write stories, and then I have written a few op-eds. And I will also say that when I'm in the process of doing it, it is kind of painful. I mean, it really does feel like work, and I'm so happy when I'm finished with the whole process. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, me too. Me too. That's why I'm always being offered opportunities to write nonfiction, to write op-eds and journalistic prose and this and that. And I'm just like, no, thank you. Because I know, you know, you say just like, give me 1,000 words on this topic. That's going to take me 2 weeks. I'm going to bleed over that. And it's going to be terrible.
And sometimes I think the shorter something has to be, the harder it is to write.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you were given only 4 months to write Sex and Vanity. So what does that mean? I mean, are you writing 8-12 hours a day? I mean, what is that?
I was, yeah, in that process. It consumed my life. Like I kind of went into a cave, didn't talk to anyone, turned off my phone, turned off my email, and just had to get out enough pages every single day to have that momentum, you know? But I knew it could be done, you know, I knew this was a story I wanted to tell. So it was already sort of been mapping out in my mind for 10 years, you know, so it was just a matter of having the opportunity to really go in there and just get it out.
Do you ever get writer's block?
Or did you so far, no.
You don't think things do?
Yeah.
I'm kidding. Talk about a time when you were writing a scene in Sex and Vanity where you just felt joy and just felt so good about what was, you know, coming out on your paper.
Mm-hmm. You know, so many of those chapters were really joyful. Especially the amazing excursions. You know, Capri was like a dream. So writing the whole Capri, the wedding sequences, the day they all go on an excursion to go visit Villa Lachowski, like that was just like so fun to write, you know. It gets a little more complicated, right, as the book goes along. And those are always, you know, when you're not just writing a travel log and making it all delicious and happy and sunny and you're at a glam wedding and you're shopping, you know, that's fun to write. And then when we get to the darker passages, that's always a little more challenging. But by and large, this was a really fun book to write, I have to say.
Well, it was so wonderful. And Kevin, we thank you so much for the gifts that you bring into the world and for your time tonight. Is there anything you'd like to say before we say goodbye?
I mean, this has been amazing. So thank you. I mean, I love all your questions and I could keep talking for hours, you know, about books and writing, but I think we've bored everyone enough.
So. Well, I could talk to you all night. And I hope next time you actually can physically come to Philadelphia so we can meet in person. Because
that would be amazing. I love Philadelphia. It's a city I always wish I could spend more time in. I was last there on the Crazy Rich Asians movie tour, and that was really fun. But we only had 24 hours in Philadelphia. We were taken for that $100 cheesesteak sandwich. Do you know about that sandwich?
It was at Barclay Prime, yes.
Yeah, it was so good.
You know,
I have to say,
your next book could be set, or at least have some scenes in the city of brotherly love. We would just love that.
Well, you never know; that just might happen. So, well,
come visit, and we'll take you to dinner. You can come over; you can see the wallpaper in person.
Sounds great.
Your cast members are my children. So, thank you so much, Kevin.
Really appreciate it, and thank you all for being here tonight. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Take care.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.